ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And first thing I need to tell you is that the information, well, let's see, where do we go? Okay.
What's the first
let's
thing?
Let's see. The first thing I need to tell you is that The Personal Wealth Coach is not only this radio program's name, it is also the name of a registered investment advisory firm that operates out of Salado, Texas, as its base, and does business all over the country and then some. And the two guys here, Jeff and
Jake.
See, I wanted to see if he was paying attention.
I'm not.
Are the principals of the registered investment advisory firm, and they're also the principals of this radio program. The two guys you're going to do the talking here. And even though we are an SEC registered investment, the firm is an SEC registered investment advisor. The SEC doesn't approve or disapprove what we do. They just regulate us. Boy, that's kind of a contradiction, isn't it? Anyway, the fact is we're not giving out investment advice on this radio program. We're giving out educational information, and we have obtained it from sources we really do believe are reliable and consistent. And we are very careful about trying to keep it reliable and consistent, but we make no warranties or guarantees. Also, what we express in this program is not, should not be construed to be the opinions of, if they have opinions, at KTEM or
Townsquare
Media.
Right.
And we have a caller on 77. The other thing is, the telephone number in here is 254-773-1400 if you'd like to join with us. Presuming that today is December 8th, the day after December 7th, of 2018.
Has there ever been a December 8th that wasn't after December 7th?
Well, I noticed that December 7th wasn't much paid attention to, and it's a big day.
That wouldn't be like a leap year. That'd be like a leapfrog day.
Yeah, anyway. Well.
Okay.
All right.
We've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Good morning to you. This concerns the $100 bill that I'm referring to. I have one that's dated 1960. And I've noticed through the years that it's changed quite a bit due to the fact of counterfeit. And I'm just needing to find out, what do you think of the future of the $100 bill is going to be? You think they're just going to go on ahead and just take it out of circulation due to the fact of so much counterfeit going on with that particular note? You have a good day. Thank you, sir.
All right. Thanks for the call. Depends on how far out you want to go. This is the big thing, is that our currency is primarily based on convenience. We use paper money because it's a lot easier to carry than chickens or gold. But
credit cards are easier to carry than...
Right. So the convenience level, there are still people without credit cards. I had a story that I didn't get to last week about the unbanked population at the smallest level it's ever been. What does that mean? The United States population, there's one measure of looking at them. The unbanked population is about 6% of the adult workforce. That means 6% of the people that are working out there don't have a bank. They don't have a
debit card. Oh, I knew there were a lot of banks out there. They own, only 6% of the people don't have banks?
They don't use banks.
I wish I had a bank.
Yeah, I wish I had a bank too. They're just not using them. They have their money in cash. They carry it in their wallets, or they have it in their house. If they have a lot, they pay rent in cash. But that number, the 6% number, has been shrinking for decades because it's just a lot more convenient to use a debit card or a credit card to make your purchases. And you have a lot less problem with theft, in that you call your company and say, hey, my card got stolen, and they shut it down. Whereas if you call the bank and say, hey, my packet of $100 bills got stolen, they say, sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's kind of like if your cryptocurrency wallet gets stolen, there's not exactly any recovering it.
No. So that, I mean, that's the thing, is that eventually the long-term market-driven force, the convenience around that, is going to make the $100 bill obsolete.
Well, the reason, and I think I mentioned this last week, but the reason the $100 bill still exists as a form of currency in the United States dollars, at least I read some stories to this effect, and I believe they're fairly accurate, is that actually during the Clinton administration there was a move to eliminate the $100 bill, to eliminate the money laundering that's done through $100 bills, because you can put a lot more money in a suitcase full of $100 bills than you can $20 bills or $50 bills. And the State Department weighed in and said, no, let's not do that, because around the world, and particularly at that particular moment in time in Russia, their economy was based on keeping lots of $100 bills. Now, admittedly, the $100 bills that they kept in their economy were mostly printed in Iran years ago. They've stopped that since then. But the point is that the $100 bills in circulation are what people around the world in less stable countries hold as their reserve against the collapse of the currency. And it's easy to forget that the ruble in 1998, which, despite the fact you think, well, 1998 is like ancient history, you know, it's only 20 years ago, and a lot of people still remember it. The ruble basically collapsed and lost its value. So if you had American dollars stuck in a vault or a safe in your house someplace, you could still buy food and you could still pay for things. Whereas if you had rubles, they became worthless. And that type of event occurs around the world. There's a lot of hoarding of American dollars in China, and they prefer to hoard $100 bills. South America is full of countries where people have their reserves in $100 bills. And by taking the $100 bill out of circulation, it would cause some tremendous economic instability around the globe. And effectively, on several occasions, and I certainly don't know if it's true today, but I wouldn't be too surprised, it would effectively collapse the economy of Russia. And collapsing the economy of Russia would not be a good thing. As we've learned, when the Arab Spring came around, a dictatorship that we consider to be less than ideal can sometimes be a lot better than the anarchy that follows and the breakup of the country. And when you talk about a country like Russia that has a lot of nuclear weapons, the idea of collapsing their economy and their system and causing chaos and anarchy to reign in a country that has probably half the nuclear weapons in the world. No,
right, right.
Bad idea.
Maybe,
bad idea.
Maybe more than half, yeah. So that kind of hits the currency thing. So what's happened this week in the market? That's kind of a
Something happened this week?
Big week in the market.
Well, the stock market, at least if we define it by the S&P 500, fell 4.6%. I think the Dow fell 4.5%. And that puts it down 1.52% year to date and puts us officially in a correction.
Again. We keep dropping down and coming back
out. We keep
out, dropping
back and down uncorrecting. And,
well, this is the third one. So yep. if you're looking technical, if you throw out all other reason and just say, let's look at charts, then you would say, well, that's the head and shoulders.
That means things are about to go the other way.
That means things are going to look good. But if you got to look at why this has happened. I wish it were all technical. Technical only works when you're looking at charts. It's really good at predicting the past.
Well, there's basically the markets are focused on future profitability of U.S. corporations. And,
right.
And we're not going to see the kind of rises in profitability in 2019. We know that already, that we saw in 2018 and 2017.
And you don't have to be psychic to know that. It's just a big bunch of the profits had to do with
right.
the tax cut, and that's not being repeated.
And there's a couple of other things. There's a series of other things that have come out that have affected this, some of which I didn't see until today. The bonanza that was expected to occur from bringing $2 trillion worth of overseas earnings home by corporations.
Yeah, it was
so
closer
far,
to
like $184 million is all they brought
billion,
home.
Billion.
184,
it's
I'm sorry,
a, it's a bigger
billion.
Difference to say
yeah,
million and billion, but it's still not $2 or $3 trillion.
So basically they brought home about 9% of the money that they've been stashing overseas rather than bringing most of it home. So that was kind of a surprise. The big one, though, is the tariffs, the threat of 25% tariffs and an out-and-out Cold War trade war between the United States and China. These are the two biggest economies in the world. And we and the Chinese economy, our economy and the Chinese economy is very interdependent. An awful lot of what we sell in the United States is made in China. And you're going to think this is really crazy, but a lot of what they make in China has components made in the United States. And their
before
economy,
they get to China sometimes.
Right.
Yeah.
We bake for instance, one of the big things with Huawei, which is the largest cell phone manufacturer and the largest cellular equipment.
Huawei or Huawei?
I heard it today.
Huawei?
It's Huawei.
I don't know the pronunciation.
In other words, is the big monstrous telecom, the largest telecom.
The one whose CFO was just arrested in Canada.
At our request.
Yeah.
So what we have is a situation, and by the way, the reason she got arrested is because U.S. components were in the equipment that they were manufacturing and sending to Iran, theoretically.
Right. Violating sanctions on Iran when she was CFO of a subsidiary company of the one she's working at.
So the point is that we had the G20 conference and we had a 90-day delay in the 25% tariffs, and it looked like a truce was coming on. The market rallied as was to be expected.
And then we had an arrest of a...
Well, no, then the president came back and said, don't get too excited about this delay. Remember, I'm Mr. Tariffs.
I'm Tariff Man.
And the market started down, and then it came out that during the G20, during the actual meeting between Chairman Xi and the president...
This is when the arrest was taking place.
We were arresting... A very senior executive in one of the largest corporations in China, one that has tight links to the government of China.
Right, very tight links. This is part of the issue. Let me take a step back and fill in some backstory here, too, if you don't mind. This is certainly an area that you have some expertise. The United States State Department and the NSA has been warning countries all over the planet about this company's 5G connection to the internet, that it's all the hardware is made in China. It's proprietary hardware, and it may be sending all the data back to China. Now, it's a little bit, just a second, you got to hear me out here. It's a little bit hypocritical because the NSA has been doing that with most of the same people's data for years. But now the Chinese get to do it, and the NSA is going to be missing out on that data unless they hack the hacker.
Well, there's a little more to it than just the government.
Yeah.
There's the fact that they're accused, at least by the United States, of using their dominance in 5G cell phone technology, which is the newest, hottest, fastest version
internet connection,
to steal trade secrets as well.
Right.
Which the NSA has never been accused of stealing trade secrets.
They've been accused of adding trade secrets.
But I'm talking about what they've not been accused of is...
They don't disseminate data from a corporation in China to a corporation in the United States. They just don't do it.
So we had this arrest occur, and then right on the tail of the arrest, out comes the news that the United States Justice Department, the same people that had the executive arrested, is also about to release criminal indictments against employees of the Chinese government, accusing them of hacking.
Right.
And while all this may be true.
The Marriott hacking is they're not going to do indictments on that yet. The reason for that is that the tools that were used in this particular case are the same tools that the Chinese government has used to hack in the past, but they were multiple times released to the public since the last time the Chinese used it. So it could be somebody else did it. It just looks like the same toolbox that the Chinese were using.
What I'm trying to say is the Justice Department announced, which is a diplomatic move, that they are going to release indictments, criminal indictments.
Right.
Criminal charges, in effect, against Chinese government officials. Right after there was an arrest directed by the Justice Department of a Chinese executive who was simply changing planes in Toronto coming from Pakistan on the way to China.
I've been around the U.S. government enough to know that it's possible that was all coincidence.
It just happened that way.
But it's really hard from an outside perspective if you're in China to not see that as a coordinated activity, for it to be happening while the two heads of state are meeting.
A number of past senior governmental officials, pretty high-level folks like secretaries of state and so on, have said normally the Justice Department would coordinate that through the president and down to the State Department before they would do something like that. But in this particular case, the Justice Department is operating independently, and they said it's a characteristic of the Trump administration that nobody trusts anybody else.
Right.
And they certainly don't trust the president not to leak it, so they just do it.
There is a fantastic chart with Wall Street Journal put it out. It's been carried by several other major publications. It's a chart of the market where the conversation happens. There's tweets. The president says everything's good with China. Everything's great. Monday morning, we have this massive rocket ship type market where it goes straight up. Tuesday comes out. It begins the day up. Larry Kudlow, who's the president's chief economic advisor, says that, you know, this thing, we could extend the truce well into the coming year. It's likely that this is the end game. We're looking at good things here. The market continues up based on that. And then Peter Navarro, who's the trade advisor to the president, says we may ratchet up these tariffs any moment. The market turned around and went the downward direction so fast that, you can look at the time of the speech. Usually in the market, there's pretty rare moments that you can point and say, this is exactly the reason why the market moved. When the Federal Reserve has an announcement, there's a movement based on that announcement. In this case, Peter Navarro's talk about tariffs caused the market to drop. It started calming down. So things looked good, started coming back up, and then the president tweeted about being tariff man, and the market has just continued on down for the rest of the week.
So the stock market, meaning the major investors in the stock market, and it certainly seems to be backed by the public because of what's happening in mutual funds, are focused right now on the specter of 25% tariffs on most of what comes out of China. And they look at what that would do to, for example, Caterpillar or Walmart or, and of course, the counter tariffs that China said that they would launch at the same time. Caterpillar is probably the bellwether for all of this, and it's down very, very substantially this year. It's basically in bear market territory.
Goldman Sachs has lost all of the gain that it got in 2017 from Trump being elected and tax cuts.
And so the bottom line to it is the market movement, usually, like Jake said, usually we can't point at some specific thing and say, here's why the market did what it did. But in this particular case, the focus is on the fact that there's been a lot of analysis of what a 25% tariff would do to American corporations. And the analysis coming back from different places, from different people using different methodologies, all comes back the same way. And it says it would be disastrous.
No.
It would cause most large American corporations to either have to raise their prices dramatically, which probably wouldn't work too well, or they wind up having vastly falling profits. And in some cases, they go into lost positions.
I would like to move the subject, still talking trade, but to oil. Are you okay talking oil for just a minute?
Okay, we're still supposedly talking about the markets. Go ahead.
Right, yeah. So this is just a different version. The market's flipping all over the place. Oil, when we look at the economy, often we use oil as a kind of a benchmark to say when there's low demand, this may mean that there's low expectation in the future for use of oil. There's a lot of extra stuff happening in the oil market. There's a lot more supply than there's been for years and years and years. There's a lot of oil out there. OPEC just met. They're considering cutting 1.6 million barrels of oil a day in their production. Now, when they say that, Russia's backed out of that, and Saudi Arabia's backed out of that, and between the rest of them, there's no way they can cut 1.6 million.
Russia and Saudi Arabia agree to that 1.2 billion cut, though.
1.6 million.
Okay, 1.6 million cut. Yeah.
Yeah. they agreed to it, but they agreed to it using language that they that is very loose language, the kind of language that they have totally ignored in the past, their own statements they just continue producing. And here's the bigger piece. Between Iran being back on the market, and they are, I have the figures right here from the U.S. Energy Information Administration, which is a great site, by the way. I don't know if you check that out. And it has the crude oil production in the United States per day, by month. And in April of this year, we produced 10.475 million barrels a day. In September of this year, we produced 11.475 million barrels a day. And if you go back farther than that, you'll see that we've gone from producing about 7 million a day in a good year to now we're getting up into the 12 million barrels a day. So even if Saudi Arabia and Russia do stick to their agreement and cut for 5 months 1.6 million barrels a day, they're not even they're just the amount of improved production in the United States for this year more than makes up for that. Mm-hmm. And that's not counting the fact that Iran is still selling oil on the market, and through specifically allowed agreements with President Trump, there are multiple countries that are allowed to continue to buy oil from Iran. So it's not like this is a grand conspiracy or anything. What it says is that oil prices are not likely to rise extremely high for the next 18 months, in my opinion. That $70 a barrel mark was just too sweet. Too many people got into the market here in the United States to pump more oil. It's now profitable to pump it even at the $50 a barrel mark. There's going to be a little bit less new drilling, but other than that, and we're already producing a huge amount.
And in 2019, new pipelines come online across the United States. They're all going to come online pretty much at the same time. That will allow a lot of that oil that's being held back right now,
right,
to actually get to market. And that, again, will have a downward pressure. One of the, and again, but we can't leave the, there is a political aspect to this. We don't normally like to talk about politics, but very factually, this president has chosen to get involved in the economies both of the world and the United States rather directly, and his actions are having economic repercussions that are very direct and very
and some of those are beneficial. Some of those are beneficial. Some of them are not.
And one of the things he did is he used the presidential pulpit to talk Russia and Saudi Arabia and OPEC in general into pumping more oil because he said we're going to cut off the Iranian oil and he doesn't want the price of oil to go through the stratosphere. But when he authorized an awful lot of Iranian oil to continue to be pumped,
right, he didn't coordinate that with them either.
And they and they right now feel a little bit like they've been stabbed in the back. Although in Saudi Arabia, that has just lots of meaning.
Yes, that's.
But the point is that
it's not quite an analogy there.
He talked up, let's make lots of oil, let's get the prices down, and he objects to the prices going up. But the reality is, the president is having a lot of effect on the economy and on the oil at this point.
Yeah.
And normally, we have said again and again, presidents don't have much effect on the economy or the market. Well, that's an exception with this one.
Right. And there, when big things like the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare came out, that had an effect. Mm-hmm. Big events like that can have an effect. This
but
president has found a lot of tools that other presidents have had available and haven't used.
And we have a caller on 773-1400, so you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. You know, there's been a lot of news coverage on the LMS protesters in France and heard this morning that it's spreading to Belgium and a couple of other countries. What's your crystal ball for that to spread all over Europe and what's going to be the effect on the U.S. markets? I'll hang up on this and thank you.
All right.
So do we get into Douglas North at this point?
Yes. I think that's
I've got
a great
some
idea
to say about
that. The cost of information has come down. This is something that is culturally significant to France. It's also significant to Belgium because there's a lot of French speakers in Belgium. The French tend to go into overdrive in their protests about very small things sometimes. The fuel tax as a percentage of the income of the people of France is tiny. They like to do big riot protests. I don't see that. That is a completely different culture in Germany. So to answer the question of do I see it spreading across Europe, no. I could see it happening in Italy, but Italy just doesn't have the same kind of passion for protests usually.
No, they have to stop and eat pizza.
Right.
And drink some wine.
The French look at it as an obligation to protest. The Italians look at it as, all right, we'll stop what we're doing maybe right now and do it. The Germans just say, I don't have time to protest. So,
well, this particular protest, at least what I read in the Financial Times out of France, is unusual. And it is indicative of what's going on around the world. And can you expect to see more of this? Possibly. And the reason I say that, normally when protests occur in France, they're pro forma protests. They are very careful where they protest,
right,
and they put the barricades up, but they put the barricades up and allow the tourists to keep flowing.
Right.
And
that's not happening now.
Then they have an organization that called for the protest, and the government can then negotiate with the organization, make some concessions, and the protests go away. Well, in this case, the government first reduced the delayed the fuel tax. That didn't have any effect. And then it abandoned the fuel tax that the protests were supposedly about. And the protests continued and got larger. And as the news media report a few minutes ago said, for those of you who heard it, the Champs-Élysées, which is Main Street, Paris, effectively, is the shops are being destroyed. This is an out and out. This has gone from a protest to a riot. And
yeah. Yeah.
The issue is there is no organizational structure to this that anybody
like
can
a,
determine.
It's like a flash mob.
It is effectively a riot. It is out of control. The government can't find anybody to negotiate with. They have met the demands of the original riot, the original protesters, and the riots got larger, and that is a powerful indication that there is a fundamental instability in France that is spreading to Belgium. Therein is the issue. And when I say that, the economy of Europe right now is kind of is in weak shape. The short-term rates are still negative. The banks, the European Central Bank has said that we're going to stop this stimulus early next year.
But unemployment rates are not great. They're nowhere near as rosy as ours.
And the Brexit issue, which is kind of we Americans are kind of tired of hearing of it at this
it's
point.
It's important, though.
Is coasting at high speed towards what's called a hard Brexit, where nobody knows what the heck is going on, to the point that there was a report this week in Financial Times that they're running out of warehouse space across Great Britain and putting up tents because of the hoarding by companies of food and basic supplies that they get from Europe, because there will be, if the hard Brexit goes through, in other words, if it just happens, then they will have no trade agreement with Europe, and they basically will be unable to import food, and they need the food from Europe. And this chaotic breakdown in governmental structure that we're seeing in Europe is compounded by the fact that they don't have a constitution and institutions to fall back on like we do in the United States. We've got chaos going on in the United States where we can't determine what the government policy is for something, and the government appears to be doing two directly opposing things at the same time, and the markets are skittish about that. But if you go to Europe, they don't have the institutional background and they don't have a constitution. We've said for a long time, the European Union, the Eurozone specifically, is headed towards a hard brick wall. It's just a matter of when. It's not a matter
right.
of if.
This is a really good numbers-based concept of what's going on in France. In 2010, the United States and France shared a similar unemployment rate, right about 10%. Since then, the United States unemployment rate is at 3.7%, and the French unemployment rate is at 9.3%. So they've come down a very tiny amount on their unemployment. There is a significant number of people out of work there still. They are still where we were in 2010. That's 8 years ago that we have had continuous, steady progress on the employment side through different iterations of government, through different iterations of corporate structures. We've been moving in a given direction. We've been slogging forward. It hasn't been with leaps and bounds. We've slogged forward. Brian Westbury, the economist out there, check him out if you haven't heard about him, has likened the recovery from the recession here to the plow horse. It's true. It has not been a racehorse. We have not jumped out of the Great Recession with huge speed and lots of bursts of movement. It's been a steady slog, but we've done it. And Europe, really, only parts of Europe have. So the German unemployment rate is 3.4%. There are multiple aspects of Europe when we look at what's going on in the UK, in Italy. Italy's flirting with the concept of breaking the euro still. They keep going back and forth. Do we get out of the euro as a currency? That's a bigger impact by far than Brexit. What's going on over there is this continual experiment of popularity. As long as it's popular to be united and have the same currency, things are okay, but we're seeing the cracks. We're seeing lots of cracks in the unity. It's not as popular to be together. Macron's whole concept is this globalist idea, which, you know, long term might be the best for the economy, but short term has not helped unemployment in France. The fact that they are sticking, you know, all the things that we can point at Trump, the president of the United States, and say he backed us out of the Paris Accord. We're not going to be keeping up with carbon emissions. Well, this whole yellow jacket riot is based on carbon emissions.
Well, it started that way.
Yeah, that's how
the
it started.
Started.
The process started that way. It was the beginning, and there's still a lot of people in the riots wearing the yellow jackets.
No, I don't mean the yellow jackets. I'm talking about the fuel tax to reduce carbon emissions.
Right.
Is what started it. It's
right.
Gone now, and the
yeah,
riots continue.
The riots continue, and when people are asked why they're doing it, it's because of the arbitrary taxation that the government can impose based on something that's really hard to understand. And that's really what's going on is that, you know, in the United States, through both George W. Bush and then Donald Trump, we backed out of the Kyoto and then the Paris Accords. If we didn't sign the Kyoto Accords, we backed out of the Paris Accords, which were signed to say this is going to have too big an impact on our economy if we cut emissions that quickly. It won't be popular, so it won't get done. And this is the big test. If France makes these agreements on the world stage of, yes, we're going – it's even called the Paris Accord. We're going to cut back on our carbon and then just keep doing what they've been doing, which is, you know, what they've set up. Then it's just a public circus saying, hey, we're going to do something that they don't do. And that's really the conundrum that we're at now is that much of the – negative sentiment from France to the United States is us backing out of the Paris Accords, which they effectively just did to appease a riot. It's very interesting stuff. The repercussions, the ripple effects of each of these decisions is stuff. Economists are going to be studying this for 100 years. This is important stuff happening right now.
It's important, I think. When looking at Europe and in the listener's questions a moment ago, to understand how the European Union and the Eurozone came into existence, and really getting a handle on that is important because the Eurozone came into existence at the behest of the French, followed by the Germans. The French were the ones who wanted to initially sponsor the idea of let's have a constitution, and they wrote one for Europe, and basically it would be France at the center, and the rest of Europe would just duplicate what France said. The Germans economically have overrun France, particularly since the Great Recession, And the French were the people who rejected the concept of having a constitution at all after it was after a compromise version was written.
Even though they're the ones that pushed
right.
for it.
Right. And so if the British leave, which I strongly suspect they're going to, and it's going to be traumatic.
Yeah, it would take a major event for them not to at this point. At this point, it's just like gravity. Unless they stop it, they're going to leave.
If they did a new referendum today, by the way, it's pretty clear that the people would vote not to leave.
Right.
But no one wants – there's too many people who believe they can profit. I mean, basically, it's a it is a populist movement to let's get rid of the European everything. Let's go back to being – let's go back to the good old days. And if they leave, that very easily could start a chain reaction and will cause the European Union to break apart. That's just a fundamental reality. But it's also a fundamental reality that we have commercials to play, and it's now 20 minutes until the end of the first hour of the show, so we need to do some commercials.
Yeah, let's do it. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. This is Jake McClure, that guy over there. Yeah, and we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And the telephone number in here remains 254-773-1400. It's about 47 minutes after the hour and, of course, after the beginning of this hour. And this is the first hour of the Personal Wealth Coach. And I'm still hearing music in my left ear for some reason. I went away. Okay. We've said a lot of negative things about the economy and the market during this hour, but I want to say something else. Bull markets historically do not end on the wave of pessimism that we're seeing
yeah,
right now.
Well, I agree.
The markets are not overpriced based on either projected earnings or trailing earnings. The markets right now are quite reasonably priced. We're in a correction again. The market, bull markets, and we've had a 9-year bull market, and the bull markets like this one, historically, without exception, have ended on irrational optimism, but very commonly 12 to 24 months before the end of the bull market, we get a wave of something, and it's generally international, and it very commonly causes a correction in the market. And there is no way that we can say with certainty that it's not different this time. But what we can say is anytime somebody says it is different this time, we shake our heads and say, probably that's a bad thing to say. And the level of pessimism and the level of selling that's going on in ETFs and mutual funds in U.S. equity shares by amateurs would suggest, based on technical history, that this is a temporary downturn in the market that will probably be followed by a last hurrah, if you will, a run-up on the other side of probably quite serious significance. Now, it may not be the same stocks that ran up before. The growth stocks, the ones that are were based on much better futures than the past, probably have sung their swan song and are headed to the pits. But
right. I'm looking at fund flows. You made a quick right. reference to that. The money is being dumped out of the market, and it's not going into bonds right now. It's coming out of bonds, and it's coming out of stocks.
Mm-hmm.
And the data that we have on this comes from lots of different places. The ICI does one, and they are, let me see here, Investment Company Institute. And they look at companies that have filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission for their 1940 Act. That's Investment Company Act of 1940. Mutual funds, basically. ETFs that are registered that way. And so they're watching inflows and outflows, and the data is always lagging. So the data that we have in the middle of the first week of December is the last week of November. And we had a $13 billion outflow in the last week of November, a almost $7 billion outflow in the second to last week. And basically looking back through the entire month of November. We've had outflows from the market while the market remained relatively flat. Coming into the end of November and then the first week of December, we see a big drop. And that's in line with people being afraid about a lot of things. There's a statement out there that bull markets climb a wall of worry. That's John Templeton. And you were just making a reference to it. When we see the amateurs dumping out of the market like that, they're really fundamentally, the danger hasn't impacted us yet. And it might change. It's a trade issue.
The cycle here can actually be seen very clearly in the late 1990s, in 1998, and this is the
Asian contagion. Yeah,
this is 20 years out from 1998. The concern about foreign values and foreign trade and foreign this and foreign that. In this case, it's tariffs. Took the market down into a pretty severe correction, which it promptly bounced back up out of again, and then ran for about 12 to 18 months in bull market mode again. And by the way, that isn't an isolated event in a normal cyclical downturn. That's exactly the kind of thing that happens, and it looks very much like that's what's going on. Can I forecast and say, oh, don't worry about it, the markets are going to recover? No, we can't say that, because we have some elements in the market that are different this time. Now, does that mean the market is different this time? Not necessarily. But we do have some elements that have some significant variance from what we normally expect to see. And that those variants are really pretty simple. One of them is in the White House. And the market short term seem to have been reacting very strongly to what the president tweets or one of his advisors says. Interesting point, though. Surveys of CEOs of Fortune 500 companies have indicated that the president's opinion expressed in his tweets is now having significantly less effect on their business decisions than it did a year ago, or certainly when he first was elected. So you can take some comfort from that. There's a distinct possibility that we will see a really nice, unexpected recovery in 2019. The markets have this powerful tendency to do the opposite of whatever the consensus agrees they're about to do. And it also is good to remember that going into the 2000 through 2002 downturn that took the market down 50%, that through most of 2000 and actually well into 2001, investors steadfastly, particularly amateur investors, refused to acknowledge that the economy was tanking, which drove the price-earnings ratio of the S&P 500 from 30, which is where it was when things really started down in the economy, to 45 in 2001, because the investors in the market refused to believe things were turning bad. Right now, investors in the market, the mass of amateur investors who are very consistently wrong, are selling. As a matter of fact, one of the article that I read said in Market Watch, which I thought was good, what's behind the sell everything craze? Because the brokers are getting these calls, these panicked calls from investors saying sell everything. And that is an indication of panic. Panic is never a good thing to pay attention to in the market. Panic is a really bad way to handle. I can't think of anything off the top of my head that gets better when you panic, and yet that's what investors are doing. So there's a big plus going on. The economy as a whole, you know, one of the things we didn't talk about, and I don't want to run out of time here, one of the things we didn't talk about that's very important, consumer spending just hit a record high. Consumer spending is 70% of the United States economy, and consumer spending is healthy as it could possibly be, and looks like it's consistently getting healthier. The fact that there are some warning flags coming up, housing, trade, we had the largest trade deficit that we've had in our history, that was just reported for October. These are indication that something unpleasant may be coming down the road. But in the intermediate and short term, let's point out that we're probably almost certainly about to have a record-breaking Christmas season for retail purchases. This causes profitability of anybody and everybody who is making stuff to sell to the public, which again is 70% of our economy, to see their earnings suddenly jump up. So when their fourth quarter earnings come in January and February, they will say, looky here, we just broke records again,
right?
Which probably will turn the market, which not probably, but certainly could turn the market around and see a massive rally in the early 2019.
Now, I expect in the next couple of weeks to start hearing the more accurate numbers on Black Friday, which are going to be pretty nice. And those tend to have an impact on people's expectations for the market as well. As we move closer to Christmas, this is particularly in a mature bull market. This is what I have seen. We hit right around Thanksgiving, mature bull market. The professionals go home. Any kind of political anything swings the market lots of points. And you have to go back a ways to see a mature bull market like this. But when you start looking at it for holidays, things come clearly. And then you have this recovery around Christmas. Whether or not we'll see that this time is kind of up in the air, but I wouldn't be surprised. It's a pretty normal event in that the economy still is doing very well. The things that are negative that we're talking about are still way off on the horizon. So that means that the market's reacting a little early. I think there's still a lot of Christmas good cheer, which is going to prevent the market from, because the market is about good cheer. If there's good cheer going around, then the market's going to act well. If people are kind of upset and depressed and not having a good Christmas, then the market acts that way too. I think we're going to have a good Christmas.
I think we are too. I think we're going to see a good Christmas and probably a good beginning to next year. Now, about the middle of next year,
yeah, things are going to get bumpy again.
That's when all the indicators that we're looking at suggest the possibility. Here are all these qualifiers I'm putting in here. Suggests the possibility of us getting into the early stages of about to or enter into a recession. By the way, it's important to note, recessions aren't called till typically 6 months after they start.
Right. I have to wrench my arm out of socket a little bit. Remember back in June, we went to a couple of conferences, came back and talked on the radio about being confirmed that we were looking ahead and saying a lot of other people are in the economic world are believing the same thing about a possible recession 2020. The people that were against it were basically saying that the trade issues were just a bluff, that we weren't really going to move forward with it even though we'd begun. And there was a pretty good number of people that believed that. And I said, well, the president said he's going to do it. I expect him to do it, and that's going to have an impact on the entire economy. So this is me taking credit for calling that the president was really going to do what he said. I know that seems like a minor thing, but many economists, many conservative-minded people did not believe that it would happen. So there we are. We're about out of time for this hour. We have more next hour, lots more to talk about. Hopefully we'll be pretty upbeat. There's a lot of good news out there, too, in technology and medicine, and we want to cover some of that. If you'd like to contact us off the air, locally we have voicemail waiting, real live people during the week.
254-947-1111. That's 254-947-1111.
You can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can listen to recordings of this program and many others. You can read our newsletters and see our made-for-radio faces and our beautiful staff. So until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.